You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, John B. Judas, editor-at-large at Talking Points Memo, on the politics of our time, populism, nationalism, socialism. Also on the program today, Joe Biden ends the bipartisan attempt with Capetto to start a bipartisan attempt with the next Capetto. Meanwhile, Democrats begin to panic over the apparent stalemate in the Senate. Speaking of not stalemated, the Senate passed a $250 billion bill to compete with China's military and manufacturing. Incidentally, 5% of that will subsidize Jeff Bezos' flight into space. White House moves to close Guantanamo Bay. Joe Biden heads to his first overseas trip. We'll meet with Putin. We'll meet with the G7. He's back. Terry McAuliffe wins the Democratic nomination in Virginia for governor. El Salvador becomes the first country to adopt Bitcoin. And the Line 3 pipeline, protesters have occupied primary construction site. Meanwhile, the Republicans filibuster a gender pay gap legislation. It's their second filibuster. And the Senate confirms its first two Biden justices. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is the proverbial hump day. Wednesday.
Yes.
Yep. There it
is. Flubbed that, huh?
I did. Well, I back in the old days, it used to be Monday, and then they shifted it to Wednesday. So
I was not aware of that ancient history.
Well, I've just been around a little bit longer than you have. And
that's obvious. Yeah.
But Emma Vigeland is here. Hello, Emma.
Hey, Sam. How are you?
How's your newfangled hump day going?
It's going fine. I feel like it's been raining in New York, given how warm it is, and yet it has not cooled down. So lots of sweat, especially if you take the subway. So Godspeed for everybody else in New York City right now.
There you go. Great to get that update. Let's check out this. We've got a decent amount of news here, which we will get to in the second hour. I should also add Val Demings launched her campaign officially to run against Marco Rubio. And Ro Khanna has introduced a bill which will allow states to essentially carve a path toward Medicare for all. We'll see how that does in the context of the House. But the House seems to be getting ready. They're gearing up to both deal with the debt ceiling, and they're getting a little antsy about reconciliation. Progressives are starting to see the writing on the wall that maybe there is not going to be, or there is more likely than not going to be, any type of filibuster reform. So the willingness to negotiate on what ultimately becomes the infrastructure bill is getting narrowed. And of course, we also have problems with the voting rights bills that are in play, because as the Democrats dawdle, Republicans are passing legislation across the states to make it harder to vote. So this is the dynamic. We'll talk to John Judas about this as well. But let's check in. As we know, vaccine rates have slowed down dramatically. There is multiple reasons for this that people speculate. Hard to know exactly. One that was a surprise recently was revealed that through surveys that people think that they're going to be billed for it. Even though it is free, they think there's going to be surprise billing.
As internalized trauma from our for-profit healthcare system. It's one of the more depressing things that we read about in recent weeks.
That's exactly what it is. And I just contemplate that. That's stunning that we can't even give away the vaccine because people in this country have been so trained to assume that they're going to get charged for it.
Yeah, it's like a dog who just feels like it's going to get kicked every time you approach it. I mean, that's the image in my mind when I think about that dynamic.
I don't know what lesson you could take from this other than like, you know, when you have health emergencies in the future, you need to do a better job of creating confidence in your citizens that your healthcare system works and will not leave them out in the cold. And then there's another percentage of people who are just difficult to reach. They may not have the time to take off from work. They may not have the money to have transportation. So there's outreach to those type of people. And then you also have the situation where you have people who are vaccine reluctant. Maybe they just think like, oh, it's gone away. We don't need to worry about that. And then some people who are just absolutely have bought in to all of the anti-vax insanity. And I give you Sherry Tenpenny. She is a member of the Ohio House Health Committee. She is she works in the Ohio legislature.
She's an expert witness.
Expert witness. Check this out.
And some of the information that I think had been discussed on your podcast related to EMF frequencies.
That was a thought.
Because
we're all kind of hypothesizing. I mean, what is it that's actually being transmitted that's causing all of these things? Is it a combination of the protein, which now we're finding has a metal attached to it? I'm sure you've seen the pictures all over the internet of people who've had these shots and now they're magnetized. They can put a key on their forehead, it sticks. They can put spoons and forks all over them and they can stick because now we think that there's a metal piece to that. There's been people who've long suspected that there was some sort of an interface, yet to be defined, an interface between what's being injected in these shots and all of the 5G towers. Not proven yet, but we're trying to figure out what is it that's being transmitted to these unvaccinated people.
Right. It's not proven yet, incidentally. So we should just let you know that, you know, it's not proven that you're getting any transmission from the 5G or that there's any type of magnetization. I'm sorry. Just trying to move my stapler around.
Wait, what? What are you talking about?
Now I get my stapler is a little bit stuck in my hand. I'm sorry. I may have to go to
That's
break.
Exactly what she's saying.
What's that? No, I can't. I mean, I'm fully vaccinated. I don't. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And
there's some truth to this.
It's pretty subtle. It's subtle with that.
I mean, I don't know. I've noticed the dog stopped barking at me, too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And a
little callback.
All right. Oh, there we go.
You're like Magneto.
What's that? Yeah. No. All right. Well, we'll. Oh, gosh. Now we got a problem with the mic. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with John B. Judas, editor at large, a Talking Points memo. All right, folks, today's show is sponsored by, if I can get my, here we go. Hey, Hunt-A-Killer is the murder mystery subscription box. That's the most exciting date night you can do at home. I got to tell you, during COVID, this is a, and pre-COVID with my daughter, she's not like she's, she doesn't want to even talk to me anymore. So, but Hunt-A-Killer was, we had a ton of fun with this. It brings people together by challenging them to decode ciphers, clues, examine clues. You solve puzzles. You're basically wading through all sorts of evidence. You get documents, you get audio recordings. They send you case files. You eliminate suspects. You identify murder weapons. Then, if you're really smart, you crack the case and you catch the killer. It's like an escape room delivered right to your door. You can even grab some wine, hop on Zoom these days, play with a socially distant friend. Great way to reconnect with people, maybe across the country or in person if you're vaccinated. Plus, join a Hunt-A-Killer spoiler-free community. You get thousands of members to help each other solve difficult puzzles and talk about true crime. Hunt-A-Killer has 100,000 active subscribers and over 2,000 five-star reviews. Also, part of the proceeds for every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation, an organization dedicated to helping with real-life cold cases. Matt, how did it work out? Didn't you and your girlfriend play the theater one?
Yeah, it was great. It's like this theater where the owner is like, hey, we have this theater and we want to maintain it, but there was a murder that went unsolved in the 30s. Could you go sort that out for us? And yeah, it's cool. You can look at like police reports and, you know, I've watched much worse things on Netflix, looking for a sort of murder mystery. It's like you actually get to participate in it.
Yep. And the stories are really work out. We did, my daughter and I did that 1930s theater one, which was a great way to sort of just like, I don't know. I don't know if everybody has these type of experiences when they do that, but it was a good way for me to sort of like inject history into my daughter's very reluctant head. But we had fun together. We set up a, what do you call those? Cork boards with the rope and the, well, string and the tacks. It's fun. Right now you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority for 20% off your first box. Again, make sure to use the code majority for a 20% discount. Answer the question. Do you have what it takes to hunt a killer? Also, don't forget Father's Day. Father's Day is right around the corner. This is a gift that you can get right up to the last minute, Emma. But honestly,
I already got my gift.
Well, this you want.
But I might need to get a supplemental one. So
this is worth a supplemental one. And frankly, it's also I cannot recommend this enough, particularly for people, well, your age, but also, you know, my age in terms of your parents. StoryWorth is an online service and it helps your dad, grandfather, father-in-law, every father figure in your life, but also, frankly, your mom, your aunts, your grandparents, your grandmothers. They share their stories, their life stories, through thought-provoking questions about their memories and personal thoughts. It's a great way to engage them, especially if you can't be in person together, but even it is a way of sort of capturing just sort of their life memories in a way that is easy and fun. Every week, StoryWorth emails your dad or whomever you get the gift for a different story prompt. Questions you wouldn't even think about to ask, like, you know, what are the proudest moments? What are the things you're proudest of in your life? Or, you know, what was your favorite car? I mean, just stuff that you would, spurs like memories and conversations. So after 1 year, StoryWorth compile all of dad's stories, including photos, and they put it into a beautiful keepsake book that's shipped for free. This is a great way to reconnect with people that you haven't been in touch with for a while, But it's also, you know, you get to be my age and your parents, you know, they don't have necessarily the recollection that that you hope they would. Or, I mean, it happens, folks. And so a great way to sort of canonize, you know, people's lives. And it's also fun, I think, for younger people, too. You know, they could do this check in every couple of years and see if their answers are the same. Really a sweet gift that really gives not only to the getter, but to the giver, frankly. So give your dad the most meaningful gift this Father's Day with StoryWorth. Get started right away. No shipping required by going to StoryWorth.com/majority. You'll get $10 off your first purchase. That's StoryWorth.com/majority for $10 off. Check it out, folks. We will put the links to both those in our YouTube and our podcast description. And just a reminder, our show, it's folks like you who support our show. Become a member and you get the show commercial free and you get the fun half and you keep the show kicking along. All right. I want to welcome, I imagine it's got to be back to the program, John B. Judas, editor at large at Talking Points Memo. He has a new book, which is in some respects a compilation of three books since 2016. It is titled The Politics of Our Time, Populism, Nationalism, and Socialism. John B. Judas, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Glad to be there.
So let's start with just sort of the three. We'll take them almost in their three separate entities before we talk about why, you know, how they interplay with each other. But give us a sense of, you know, what the history of populism, you know, briefly has been in this country up until now in the slightly different strains of populism that we have.
Well, populism really starts in the United States in the 1880s and 1890s in the South and the Midwest and the prairies. And it initially is a left-wing movement. It's not a right-wing movement. And it pits the people against the establishment or elites. Who were in the establishment or and elites, and who's the people gets redefined with each generation politically. But the main thing is this kind of opposition. And what we found in America is that we have both a left wing and a right wing variety. We have on the one hand, we have the populists of the 1890s. We have Bernie Sanders today. We also have George Wallace, and we have Donald Trump. And the difference between the left wing and the right wing variety is you find many of the same issues domestically in terms of policy. George Wallace remained a New Dealer. He was for progressive taxation, things like that. He's also a racist. Donald Trump, he was against multinational corporations being able to get up and leave American workers in the lurch. He wanted better trade deals that benefited American workers. But he was also saw Mexicans who come into the country as rapists. Charlottesville, the Nazis were fine people, you know, those kind of things. So I think with the right wing populists, you always get this third element, which is to say that the idea that the establishment is coddling African-Americans, Muslims, illegal immigrants, what have you. There's always a third group. But in terms of the heart of the domestic stuff, you get the same kind of politics. Populism arises when there's a significant minority of the people, and they could even be a majority, that believe that the major parties and their leaders are not addressing the issues that are of concern to them. You know, that happens in the 1890s with the Republicans and Democrats, and it happens, it's happened in our era with the leadership of the Republican and Democratic Party. I mean, Trump was responding really to again the George the Jeb Bush wing of the Republican Party really being oblivious to the working class voters that were becoming interested in the Republican Party over the previous 20-30 years. Bernie Sanders again to the wing of the Democratic Party who thought it was fine to give speeches to Goldman Sachs and not report what you actually said to them on a promise, things like that. So again, it arises at these particular moments when what's breaking down is a consensus that's held together Republicans and Democrats in Europe, but Christian Democrats and social Democrats. So you have that's when populism is a kind of early warning signal that there's a breakdown in the politics. It doesn't necessarily solve the problems, and that's certainly obvious with Trump. But it's a sign that there are these big problems looming in the country that have to be addressed.
Are there specific, aside from that sort of third element of right-wing populism, right, which involves making sure that you have some type of other villain in addition to the elites or the ones that you think that the elites are coddling, I guess. How does the sort of policy sets line up with left-wing populism versus right-wing populism? I mean, is it always just simply, is there any distinguishing factors between the economic prescriptions of those two populist movements?
Well, with Trump, again, let me say what was positive and what was negative. There are some things that Trump did that Biden has carried over that are very positive. And one of the things would be industrial policy, the idea that the government has to take a greater role in encouraging industries that are vital to the American national security, America having its own steel industry, are not ceding the rare earth minerals to China, whatever. You know, that was positive. Operation Warp Speed, that was a triumph of not just American technology, but what happens when you have the government taking a big role in supervising and regulating and at the same time subsidizing industry. So, that was, again, a positive aspect. The negative aspect was stigmatizing immigrants, a lot of anti-union stuff, in spite of the fact that Trump and his campaign sang a different song.
Right.
He really let the Labor Department declare war on unions, making it very difficult to organize. The regressive tax bill that he passed. So, I think that's the kind of characteristic you get with the right wing populism that you wouldn't have gotten with, a Sanders presidency or, with Biden, who has incorporated a lot of the issues and approaches that were presented both by Sanders and Trump in 2016.
Let's move on to nationalism. And we should say that you sort of in real time wrote these books that are now sort of, I guess, sections of this big book as these things were unfurling. I mean, are these things always sequential on some level as they begin to percolate in society? Or is there a certain inevitability if you've got a certain type of populism, the context that a populist movement grows in also will create a nationalist movement?
In American politics, I think you often find the populism and nationalism joined, and certainly in Europe, they're very much joined. The point that I really wanted to make about nationalism is that a common national sentiment, the idea that we're all, you know, that there's something called Americans, that there's something called the French, this kind of idea, which we grow up with as Americans, is essential to democracy, and it's essential to having an advanced welfare state where I'm going to be paying taxes to support people, you know, to provide insurance, to provide roads, build for people that I will never see or know. I have to believe that those people are worthy of my support because they are Americans. And when that kind of sentiment begins to break down, when some people say, well, these aren't real Americans, we're supporting illegal immigrants or whatever, then the, you know, the welfare state itself starts to break down. So that's very important. Then there's another step, and
can
that
I just
is
ask you just about that in okay. terms of nationalism, because the way that you frame that in terms of it's important to have some type of pride and shared belonging, but it seems to me that one can be nationalist and say, yes, no, I am all about America, but I'm also going to be rather specific as to who I include as being American. So I'm not going to support, you know, that subset of people or not.
Yes, and that's obviously that's when it becomes problematic. But it also is problematic on the other side when you have people saying, well, you know, I'm a cosmopolitan. I think we should be citizens of the world. I don't think we should. I think we should be as much concerned in our policy with what's going on to people in, let's say, South America as we are concerned with people who are going in South Chicago. That's not a way of doing business politically that accords with our own psychology, with our national psychology. And I think that some people on the left refuse to understand that this question of is this policy in the national interest is very important and has to be taken into consideration.
Is there one, you know, I think Democratic politician who positions themselves in that way, though, to say that, oh, we're going to be just as concerned with somebody in this Asian country or this, you know, whatever, Thailand, pick a random nation, than we are going to be with the citizens of Indiana. I mean, the flip side of that is I think that the right wing extremism is legitimately represented by a number of Republican politicians. Right. And I don't see this posture as actually being said by one Democratic politician.
Okay, so let's do two things. First, on the in terms of the intelligentsia, and it's not just left wing; it's liberal. You do find people taking these positions, and you know, I quoted my old friend Dylan Matthews from Vox, and he's a former New Republic colleague in my book. So yeah, you do find that the extreme position, and it's been debated over history. The other side, the more common side, is the idea that comes up during the Democratic debates. Should we offer free health care, if we have Medicare for all, to anybody who's in the country? In other words, regardless of whether they pay taxes, been here, past citizenship, residency, and the Democrats all raise their hand. Well, not all of them, but most of them. That again is a failure to recognize the importance of nationality and citizenship to having this kind of an advanced welfare society. So that's the that's what I would say is among politicians of a liberal or democratic stripe, the more common way in which this occurs. I mean, I think the other thing is an indifference to border security as an issue, which concerns many Americans. There again, you get a feeling that, well, it just does, you know, some version of open or virtually open borders is a failure to recognize that as a nation, we have to regulate who is and is not a citizen.
But isn't there something, I think, a moral difference in between saying, oh, we're going to allow people who are not citizens to access our healthcare system and have free healthcare, then we are going to demonize an entire group and be isolationist and say, drum up populist sentiment with, you know, by saying immigrants are bad, et cetera. I mean,
one is a malady on the right, one and the other is a malady on the left. I mean,
I don't see it as a malady.
Obviously, if you weighted them on the great moral scale, I would say that, you know, the right is worse, but. Again, if you look at Canada with its single payer system, you can't just go into Canada and demand, let's say, a preventative healthcare checkup. In the United States, you go into an emergency room, and no matter who you are, you know, there's again, people who are not undocumented get care as well as people who are here as citizens. But in terms of normal care, surgery, all this kind of stuff, it's again, Canada's single payer system works according to rules, and according to rules that you have to show proof of residency, all this kind of stuff. And you know, it's very hard to run a national system if you don't have that, just in fiscal terms. But it's also a problem, again, in terms of taxpayers supporting people that they don't know, that they're not going to, you know, ever meet. So that, in that sense, yes, nationality and a sense of nationality is really important to programs that we support.
Is this, and I'm just trying to understand, are you saying from a functioning standpoint or as a political matter? I mean,
both. That's what I'm saying. Both.
My experience in both in Europe and in Australia was, when I was in Australia, I had some ear problems over the course of months, and I walked in. Nobody looked at my documentation or anything to that effect. And I think I've had a similar experience in France. But putting that, is as a functioning matter, what would be problematic? We have a good sense of how many people are in this country at any given time, relatively speaking. You could take that measure. I mean, I don't want to get too hung up on the specifics of this, but we know how many people go into the emergency room. We can extrapolate how many people have a connection with it.
Yes, that's right. We know that. But in terms of normal benefits that people get from being an American and paying taxes, leave aside the emergency room. We have a right as Americans to believe that there should be certain qualifications before people get those benefits. They shouldn't just be given to everybody. I'll give you another example from the British Labour Party, which got into a lot of trouble over the last 3 or 4 years. And part of it was, again, over their rejection of a sense of nationality. At the Brighton Labour Conference before the election in 2019, they voted to allow people who were residents from any of the EU countries to vote in national elections. Now, that just seems to me nuts. But again, I think that's an example. It's not, you know, racist or bigoted, and it's not Nazis. It's not right wing.
I understand.
But it's a denial of a basic a kind of idea of nationality that you need in order to have a functioning democracy or welfare state.
I'm just not clear. I feel like we keep shifting categories here in terms of like the idea that if we had a Medicare, I mean, we do this with public education, right? I mean, you're allowed to go to public education regardless of whether you're a citizen or not. That doesn't break down public education. I mean, as a political matter, if you're saying that it creates a certain amount of resentment, that's one case that one could make. But as a functionality matter, it works in public education. If what you were saying was correct, we wouldn't have a functioning public school system.
Well, we have a functioning public school system, but it has a lot of problems. And you can look in California and Texas, and there is, it does breed a lot of resentment. I'm not, look,
but my, here's my, political.
You, I mean, I will tell you my position, which is that we should have a path to citizenship for the whatever, between 10 and 12 million undocumented, unauthorized immigrants who are in this country. But particularly with respect to unskilled immigrants who come through the into the country and compete with people who don't have college educations, and we should be very careful about that. And one way of doing security, it's not so much building walls, but some kind of E-Verify program that would allow, that would force employers to verify whether someone is, has a green card or is a citizen before hiring. So if you had some combination of that, you'd have the best of both worlds. You wouldn't have this huge underclass in this country of people who are not here legally and who are easily exploitable. But at the same time, you would start to have a situation, you know, which we see the kind of thing happening now, where people who have only a high school education or a 1 year of community college suddenly find themselves in a much stronger bargaining position vis-a-vis employers than they've had over the last 50 or 60 years. And one of the reasons they haven't had a good position is because there have been so many unskilled, without education, immigrants coming in the country, many of them illegally, who compete with them. So again, that my program is both sides. Path to citizenship plus E-Verify.
I don't want to get too hung up here, but my sense is the reason why we have a different situation right now is not because we have less competition in that labor market, and we've been at net zero of immigration for years now. It is because we have more of a robust unemployment benefits, and also with the child tax credits and the funding that we have provided over the course of three COVID bills, which is creating that dynamic for low-wage workers, as opposed to they're not going out and competing for jobs right now.
Yeah, we have both. Pretty much net zero immigration, and the unemployment benefits and childcare, and that's
right. My point
really
is,
boosting. That's right. Boosting wages in a way we haven't seen for. 50
I agree.
Years.
We've had that net zero immigration for quite a while, though. I mean, that has been we've had that dynamic for.
I know, but we've had we haven't had that for a long time. And the time when we see the real problems happening from, let's say, you know, 1980 to the early 2000s, it's a time when we had enormous increases in immigration. And we had, at the same time, companies successfully beating down the union. So, you know, I think if you put those two together, you see a lot of the problems of how America has become so unequal, and particularly how the lower 30-40% has really gotten screwed over the last, really since the 70s, 1980s. Right. And, you know, just to add one more point, you know, when we had the enormous achievement of those Civil Rights Acts in the mid-1960s, what that meant was really was we were in a position where a lot of American blacks who could not enter the mainstream were suddenly in a position where they could legally. Let's leave aside the discrimination. But at the same time, that was the period where we had the immigration reform, 1965, family reunification. So we get in cities like Los Angeles and Chicago, African-Americans with only high school education having to compete for jobs. I think that you would have seen a different situation, again, if we would have had a better sense of our own nationality and what our labor needs were, et cetera. So I'm just going back to the same point. about the importance of nation, nationality, doing things that are in the national interest, worrying about our citizens here. And I'm not saying we shouldn't worry about people elsewhere. And obviously, there are a lot of issues like climate change that we can't do by ourselves. I mean, we have to do with other people, pandemics among them. So I'm not against internationalism, but I'm arguing for a certain sense of nationalism.
Let me just just last question to put it to rest, so I get it, so I'm clear. If we had a system where we would allow anyone to come into the country, but of course we would, but not there would be a border, and we would take your information and would say if you want to, would put everybody on a path to citizenship who walks through in some fashion. Would that be problematic? I'm just trying to get
at anybody. Yes, that would be a disaster for workers in this country. It would destroy unions.
Okay.
We wouldn't have 10%. We would have like 3% unionized, because there would just be too much of a glut of workers on the market, and employers would be in an extraordinarily strong position. Okay. You'd also have a lot of towns that felt that they were overtaxed, having to provide benefits that they couldn't afford.
That would be
my answer.
A math situation, and then the resentment that would come from it, both ends would be problematic. I mean, those are two separate equations, it seems to me. All right. So this is the part that I think you would argue that the left doesn't understand where that nationalism, the importance of that nationalism, and why it's bubbling up in both virulent ways and in ways that are helpful. Would that be fair?
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on to socialism. Where does the socialism emanate from?
The socialism to me has astonished me, because I was a socialist in the 60s, and former editor of Socialist Revolution, a journal that was put out in San Francisco, was later called Socialist Review. But by the 1980s or so, very much like what happened to Bernie Sanders, I started to question what socialism really could mean in the United States. And I still defend it theoretically, but then all of a sudden in the 2010s, you see these start before Bernie Sanders runs, you start to see these polls where kids, and we're talking about like 18 to 29 year olds, suddenly 50% say they doubt whether capitalism is a good system, and they consider socialism. And so really what's happened is we've had this kind of revival of socialism, but it's not been the socialism that I understood in the 1960s, the worker ownership and control of the means of production, a kind of vision of a democratic version of the Soviet Union, where you'd have central planning of some kind, but you'd also have democracy. It's been much more like Scandinavia. It's been much more in the old spirit of Christian socialism, cooperation, racial, sexual equality, issues like that. And, from my standpoint, enormously positive and promising for American politics, but still limited in terms of its appeal, because, for most of the people in America who are over, let's say, age 45, they grew up in the shadow of the Cold War. And this happened in the election in 2020. That socialism still means Soviet Union, Venezuela, Cuba, what have you. So I think that's a big reason Biden had an enormous amount of trouble in South Florida. Bernie Sanders would have had trouble around the country, I think, except for, some zip codes in New York City and some college towns and stuff like that, because of socialism. But again, from my standpoint, it's been an enormously positive development. And, you know, with Biden himself or with Elizabeth Warren, what you see to a great extent is a kind of shadow socialism. I mean, they wouldn't call themselves socialists, and Warren specifically said she wouldn't. But you see the same kind of attempt to shift power and wealth away from capital, away from big owners, toward labor, towards workers, toward ordinary people. That's characteristic of socialism. And, you know, obviously with Warren and with Biden's relief and recovery programs as well. So, you know, all power, and maybe in 20 or 30 years, a lot of these things will be acceptable. It'll be acceptable to have a debate over democratic socialism. But right now, again, I think it's limited in terms of its political appeal.
What is the relationship between these three? I mean, is there a sequencing that goes on here, or do when you get a populist sentiment, does it across the country? Do you get the context for populism?
Right.
Is it inevitable that out of that will come nationalism and socialism? I mean,
well,
in a vacuum, right? I mean, because I would actually, I'd push back a little bit on the 45-year-old threshold, because as a member of as almost a 55-year-old myself,
you are. That's amazing. I don't believe it.
Well, 54. but as someone in that age group myself, I think it wasn't so much the Soviet Union as it was living in the shadow of the rejection of the yippies and the hippies for my generation. But I don't want to get too far into the Gen X thing. But I think the absence of essentially the baggage from the Cold War and from, what we saw in the 60s, there was no obstacles to sort of embracing socialism for a lot of younger people. And I can tell you that with a 15-year-old daughter, I can tell you that what's happening with the even younger kids is even more dramatic.
Yes.
To the extent that one can get a notion from TikTok and Snapchat, but in terms of like the context for these different ideologies to grow, how do they relate to each other?
Putting their nationalism aside for a minute, populism, socialism, because the American Socialist Party starts right after the heyday of American populism. 1901 versus, let's say, 1892. They're both responses to a breakdown in consensus, in the prevailing politics of the time. In the 1890s, it was laissez-faire capitalism, the idea that government should help business, but not anybody else. Labor unions should be illegal. There shouldn't be such a thing as unemployment insurance, so on and so on. A lot of these things that eventually were adopted by the New Deal. That gives rise to both the populists and the socialists at the same time. At our present time, I think, you have to look at the Great Recession as a really key event in prompting populism and socialism on both the left and the right. I mean, the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, both in their own odd ways, come out of the Great Recession. The upsurge of skepticism about capitalism among the young comes out of the Great Recession, and the idea that, again, if you look at the heart of the socialists, from what I could tell from the votes, were kids who had gone to college but not post-grad. I mean, it was this certain group that a lot of whom end up working as Uber drivers who thought they were going to do much better. Again, I think that's a lot of that is a product of the Great Recession. And now on top of that, we have the pandemic and the current recession, which is increasing it, and which is also undermining one of the central ideas of a more conservative outlook, which is that government is bad, and that it's that the way to get the economy moving, society moving, is to withdraw government. And, you know, with both Trump, Sanders, later with the Democratic candidates now, complete repudiation of that idea, and the idea that government's very necessary. And, the pandemic made that point in spades. And, the just last thing I'll say is that there recently was this, I think it was this week, this bipartisan bill on industrial policy was passed. Inconceivable 20 years ago that Republicans and Democrats would do that. And, it's justified in terms of threats from China, but, we should have a semiconductor industry in this country. I mean, it's important. Pharmaceuticals, we should make a lot of things. We shouldn't have to rely on other people, and that'll build up a middle class again in the country. So those are all good things. And a lot of them are products of the disillusion with the kind of, I guess neoliberal is the term that people use, or market liberalism that prevailed in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. And it was just completely destroyed by the Great Recession.
Right. And that had cut across both parties. So give me a sense of what you think happens next. I mean, there's obviously a lot of factors. If I had told you that there was a burgeoning populist movement, it might be predictable that we would see rise in at least right-wing nationalism and in socialism on some level. And I don't know that we've seen the left-wing nationalism that you're talking, or broadly embraced on the left anyways. But where would you anticipate what we would see next?
Well, first, let me say that Biden does embrace. And again, left liberal in this country, the terms get mixed up anyway. But, you heard him in his speech when he won the election and in his state of the United States of America. I mean, he made a big deal about it. And I think the Biden people understand that to be an important issue. We're in a very touchy situation in this country, and similar, I would say, in continental Europe. But we don't have to get into that, where we're really facing in the 2022 and 2024 elections a return to the kind of stalled realignment, the kind of unstable equilibrium that we faced for the last 20, 30 years. I mean, Biden's really trying to break through. And in order to break through, the Democrats are going to have to win, and they're going to have to keep the House and increase their margin a few votes in the Senate in order to continue to do these things, and in order to give credit and credibility publicly to the kind of government intervention that they propose. There is I continually be shocked by Trump. I mean, I thought in 2017 he would sort of sand off the rough edges from his campaign and be presidential. And, we really did get a demagogue, a very dangerous one. And then what happened after November election was also pretty scary. I don't know how much that's going to continue in the Republican Party and how much a danger to our democracy it will pose. I would imagine if the Democrats win in 2022, what you'll see is a lot of Republicans finally realizing that they have to part ways with Trump. And, what you might see is a Republican politics, embodied by somebody like Marco Rubio, that finds some common ground with Democrats on the subject of government and the economy. So, that's the most that would be the most positive outlook that I could give you. The negative one you can give yourself, which is,
the Democrats
Trump, voter suppression, real doubts about American democracy. And that looms in a way that it's never loomed before in my lifetime.
I mean, I think 2022, the idea that it's going to be that Democrats are going to pick up seats seems hard to imagine.
One seat in the Senate, I'd say. I mean, there are enough vulnerable elections. The House, they have to keep it. And right. I'm more worried about the House.
That's interesting. And let me just touch on on your rosy scenario in terms of like the Republicans. I mean, because from my perspective, the Tea Party was the only material difference between the Tea Party, it seems to me, and let's say the moral majority. You could virtually draw a direct line there, it seems to me. The only difference is money. That was an era in the Tea Party where there was a tremendous amount of money, a lot of it Coke money, but also, you know, Foster Freeze. And there was, back in the aughts or pre-aughts, even it was just, the Scaifes maybe, and that's about it. And a couple others, but there was a tremendous amount of money that crept into Republican politics. So there was the ideology was really no different. It just been rebranded, but the funding sources were independent and basically grew a sort of a competing a product within what was more or less the same sector. But from an ideological standpoint, there was really nothing tremendously different. It was just, which team am I on in this exact same league, essentially.
Okay. Well, look, let me say a few things. I was doing a story on the Tea Party, and what was it, like 2010? And you remember Grover Norquist? He's no longer a big shot in Washington the way he was then.
Yeah.
And he was always a good person to talk to about this stuff. And he said, all these movements are fungible. That was the word he used. Anti-tax. He's saying the same thing you're saying. Anti-tax, religious right. They just change their coloration. And I think that a lot of the Tea Party has vanished because we went into Trump. I mean, they're now Trump supporters.
They're MAGA, right.
And the people that I interviewed then from the Tea Party, who incidentally stopped talking to me a few years ago, your media, blah, blah, we won't talk to you, went into the Trump world. So yeah, that's point one. As far as the Tea Party itself, it was a funny kind of movement because it was, on the one hand, a very decentralized movement of all these groups that, in order to understand, you had to go, you could look on the web pages, you could go locally, and they had a lot of different kinds of ideas. Illegal immigration was a big deal, especially in the South and Southwest, but, more anti-tax, anti-government elsewhere. On the other hand, they had these huge group, Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works, that were funded by plutocrats, the Koch network. Now, one of the things that happened in the Republican Party, and I saw this when I used to cover the Christian Coalition, is that the people, the Koch network people, are not they're free traders. They're also open borders people. I'm using again in open borders. They want the immigrants, fine. Let them in. Guest workers, great idea. They're not pro-Trump, so there is this kind of real division in the Republican Party that's going to have to play out between the Koch Karl Rove wing, Chamber of Commerce wing, and the base that is this group of people that have come up: Moral Majority, Christian Coalition, Guns for America, that are now Trump supporters. And that's to the Democrats' advantage, but it's also scary because the Trump people are genuinely have taken an authoritarian turn.
John B. Judas, at our large talking points memo, the book is Politics of Our Time, Populism, Nationalism, Socialism. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
That was really fun. And I like it when you argue with me.
Well, maybe we could do that again. I appreciate you coming on. All right. We're going to take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back after this. Well, that was a energetic exchange, I thought. I mean, I think that, look, there is it is interesting to get, like, you know, sort of that layout of the different responses at the but the bottom line is there is a problem in our society and different people react differently to it. And so there needs to be something fundamentally fixed within the context of our government. I think that part is clear and we can all agree on. But with that said, another thing we agree on is, that the, for those of you watching us on Peacock, we will see you tomorrow. And for those of you who are, still with us on, our other distribution platforms, or maybe listening even into the future. We're going to head into the fun half of the program. Want to thank David Feldman for coming on today. he's not going to come on today. Maybe we'll have him on Friday. I don't know. We'll see. Oh, no, I think we're booked, right? folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you you support the show, and you get fun half material every single day practically. I mean, for the most part, you get it every single day, but I'm not going to – I like to manage expectations.
Right.
Who knows? Maybe, you know, I guess last week we did a show – where we didn't even have a fun app. That was a tech day.
Yeah. I mean, it's not probably not the best idea to manage expectations when you're trying to get people to become members, though. Maybe just say the whole, say the, no, that's say the best reality. Time.
That's the, yeah, that is, we could have this debate. I can tell you whatever's
we're the, in the mood today, I guess.
Whatever's in the least effective means of getting members. That's what I'm good at.
Yeah.
That's where I bring in my, I bring out the big guns in terms of my business. but we're getting people on the IM are really going to town right now. really going to town. I quite enjoy that. I would like to go.
Maybe more of that. If that's what people like, if they're into that sort of.
Yeah. I mean, I could have, like, as soon as the disagreement in our perspectives was illuminated, I was like, we could debate this guy, or we could, you know, learn what his book's about. And so,
right. I mean, I kept saying, like, I don't want to keep going sideways on this, but it there was, I have to say, and, you know, in a sort of more open format and anticipating this, a conflation, it seemed to me at times, between what was, you know, what one could perceive as a political reality or political limitations versus practical reality or limitations.
If you wanted to make a case for some of these things in terms of how you're going to brand it politically, as you're saying, I'm more sympathetic to that argument.
Right.
Than
but I mean,
am. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have had an experience in France with healthcare where a half day of care and no questions asked. And my understanding is France has a pretty developed sense of nationalism. But I think the other, like the more serious point is with regards to like open borders or even like the path to citizenship for all comers, if the left was in a position to do that, it'd also be in a position to alter the environment of labor exploitation in this country.
Exactly. I mean, that is the thing that I think is like a little bit, there's nobody going out there who are saying my entire policy prescription is to just do this one thing, right? Like, yes, it is the case that more low-wage, low-skilled workers would depress wages and create more competition amongst low-skilled workers. In fact, more, if you let in high-skilled workers, it would also, at one point...
That's such a classist classification, though, too. I mean, it's just like...
Well, I mean, it's a way of describing just sort of like, you know, how much education that you've had, that will, you know, what kind of jobs that you would be available to you in, and what kind of skills would match up. But you could make the same argument with high skilled if you thought that there was going to be as many coming in. But the whole point is that, and I, this is the point I was trying to make with why we have seen wages rise in this country has not been a function of a lack of low-wage workers coming in. I guess conceivably you could say that during the during COVID, there was, you know, people were shut out to a certain extent. I imagine there was some, but we had net zero immigration to this country from Mexico across the Mexican border for years and years and years. And we didn't see wages rise. That the impetus, now ultimately, I guess, I mean, if we, you know, the impetus for rising wages has been in part a function of a couple of things, it seems to me. One being that people are trying to ramp up their production and get their businesses going so quickly that they don't have the time to wait around to find the workers willing to work at that crappy job for that crappy pay. And there's also workers are basically saying, like, you know what? I'm not as desperate. I mean, this is ultimately what it comes down to. And more workers on one side that are competing against you, and then more things that have been, for lack of a better term, decommodified because you're getting payments. They're not technically decommodified, but they're not as the needs that you have are not as coercive in that moment because they're being subsidized in some function. That's where worker power comes from. And the only thing that's changed on those two sides was the side that provided subsidies so that the need to work was not as coercive. I don't think that's what's keeping people from going back to jobs. I think to a certain extent, there's still, we have a lot of jobs open, but I think there's a lot of factors that are raising wages, but the idea that it's necessarily like the only policy program that would be implemented would be open borders, and then everything else is exactly the same, is a little bit hard to
And there's no one on the left in power that's advocating for that. But to me, like, the conflation of left-wing populism with the faux populism on the right, aka nationalism, I mean, I like, that would be he should be interviewed by Sagar for that new show they're doing. It's like a perfect fit.
Wow. Emma. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment. Matt, before you go, tell us what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe.
Well, last night I played about 2.5 hours. We did, I got routed at Shiloh. In the Civil War, I did not, retreat fast enough. And so you can see me losing that. But anyway, tomorrow night we have Joshua Kahn Russell talking about mental health, which is timely, I think, probably for the last 4 years. And also we'll be talking about psychedelics. So that's tomorrow night, 8 o'clock Eastern, Left Reckoning. Go subscribe to the YouTube page, folks.
Don't forget the AM Quickie, and see you in the fun half, 646-257-3920. Check out Nomi's show, youtube.com/TheNomiKey Show. left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.